The question in front of the U.S. Supreme Court is whether workplace discrimination on the basis of sex applies to gay and transgender workers. And six of the nine justices, they say yes, it does. Sex discrimination includes discrimination for LGBTQ plus workers. The High Court released the opinion yesterday, and that's what we're talking about now on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Kate Archer Kent. Join our conversation. What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court ruling? How do you think it will change things? And are you part of this community? What is it like for you to navigate the healthcare system? Do you have concerns during this Pride Month, even though it's supposed to be a time to celebrate who you are? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Wes Shaver, who's the president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc. Wes, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Want to get your reaction to what many are calling a landmark case that came out of the Supreme Court yesterday.
Well, yesterday was a pretty surprising day for all of us. The immediate reaction was, oh, my gosh, the work is being heard. You know, we always talk about how important it is to celebrate not just pride in the spirit of the LGBTQ plus community, but the work that people have been doing for the last 50 years. And that work includes working to change legislature, working to change processes, working to, change discrimination, looking to change views of prejudice. So the final decision and the ruling is indeed a major surprise and definitely a landmark moment for LGBTQ plus people.
You said surprise twice there, so certainly not what you expected. Why didn't you think that the work that has been done in these past decades was, as you put it, being heard?
Well, the LGBTQ plus community, ever since the latest administration took office in 2000, you know, at the end of 2016, there was really, we were all immediately threatened. We were aware that there would be very conservative and religious based views and policies enacted. And especially for transgender folks, we felt a heightened need to support and to be vocal about the needs of that, of not the whole LGBTQ plus community, but especially those folks. And seeing as that now we're on one side of the spectrum, we're facing movements with people of color and with social unrest and unjust systems in that aspect. This Pride Month, just last week, we saw rollbacks of protections against transgender folks. So to see this decision come just a few days after that, it was surprising. It seemed almost odd that we would have this very positive decision made coming off the heels of one that potentially is, or that potentially that is harmful to some folks within the community.
And we're talking with Wes Shaver, who's the president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc., and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How does this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court change things in your world? Are you a member of the LGBTQ plus community? What do you want people to know about how this or other circumstances in our world right now affect your life? You can give us a call and share your experience with us at 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And Wes, let's talk more about what you were just mentioning. On Friday, we saw the Trump administration announce a policy that rolls back rules protecting transgender patients from discrimination by doctors, hospitals, and health insurers. What is it about the Supreme Court ruling and this step by the administration? It seems like they don't quite fit.
Right. It seems like a complete contradiction. But I think so. We within our community, and something that I always talk about is the importance of, as we make progress and as we talk to people, as we engage with people, as we listen, but also as we share, there's this idea that if we could change people's minds, we could change people's hearts. And that's when you could really affect change. And based on what I've read and my interpretations and conversations about the Supreme Court ruling is, you know, the two votes, the two, you know, surprising votes, it appears as though they really were conscious of that decision. And really, I understand there is some tricky language there and some potentially interesting interpretations down the road. And LGBTQ plus people may have some bumps down the road if they're ever faced with any lawsuits or issues. However, it does appear that the messages are being heard and that these two potential individuals maybe had a change of heart or at least mind when it comes to the application of that civil rights movement, that 1964, you know, bit of history there. So I'm hoping that despite what I consider to be contradiction of the party, that people are opening up their minds. They are listening to the community and they're listening to how these things do correlate to injustices in human and equal and civil rights.
Yeah, and when you're talking about those two individuals, we're referencing Chief Justice John Roberts and also Justice Neil Gorsuch, who actually wrote the opinion for the majority on this, who are conservative justices on the court who agreed that this sex discrimination does apply to gay and transgender people. What about, though, this rule that the Obama administration had put in place when it comes to healthcare providers? How crucial is that for people who are LGBTQ plus to get the healthcare that they need?
It is. I can't even describe how crucial that it is. LGBTQ plus people really, really suffer from inadequate healthcare, not having proper resources, not even having access to the tools of how to find resources. You know, there's layers to the LGBTQ plus community, and they're very intimate and they're very personal. And these protections and these opportunities that the Obama administration allowed for people to kind of open up and be vulnerable and maybe venture out to find resources and in healthcare and systems that will allow them to live an authentic life are very important to our community. It's hard to explain. It's something that I think most people take for granted, but so many LGBTQ plus people live in hiding. They're afraid to confront some of their personal issues or health issues. And the decision to roll back some of those protections is actually, it's devastating. Not only is it taking a step back in just progress and history and equality, but it's really regressing how the community faces the world we live in today. And it's putting back up blocks, blockades, barriers, and it's forcing potentially somebody who was ready to take a risk and venture out to find resources. It's really pushing those people back down. It's forcing them into hiding. It's forcing them to not live a healthy, authentic life. And that's really the ripple effect of these decisions that affect people by decision makers and policy makers and lawmakers that just don't understand how their decisions affect other people.
We're talking with Wes Shaver, who's the president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc., and we're discussing Pride during the pandemic and in light of yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is your community doing for Pride in light of this pandemic with gatherings of people not allowed? Let us know how you are marking the occasion. 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Wes Shaver. He's president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc., a group that had to cancel its celebration of the LGBTQ plus community. And in the announcement, the group said that people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning are at a greater risk during the pandemic. That's because we know of health disparities and that people face barriers to accessing health care. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How are you marking this month's Pride celebrations when we can't gather together? Do you normally attend a festival? Maybe you identify as LGBTQ+. What do you want people to know? And how does this latest Supreme Court ruling maybe change things for you? Maybe it doesn't. Share with us at 800-642-1234. Wes, Pride Fest in Milwaukee canceled until some point in 2021. How did you come to this decision?
Well, the decision, Milwaukee is known for being the city of festivals. And every weekend throughout the summer, there's a group, the United Ethnic Festivals, that host come together, and each individual organization puts out a festival. We have Pride Fest, Polish Fest, Festa Italiana, etc. And what drove the decision was realizing in early March that large-scale concerts and events were canceling. And they were canceling events. And actually, it was the Kenny Chesney concert that was coming to Milwaukee that was canceled. And that's what alarmed me to think, oh boy, we probably need to cancel now in order to protect our volunteers, our performers, and our festival guests, but also to make a rational and reasonable decision about protecting our financial solubility. We have a responsibility to our organization to make the best financial decisions. And at that time, we were the first event in the city to really cancel. We were kind of hoping that we would have this stay-at-home order. We'd be home for a few weeks. We'd get some clarity with the pandemic. But it was very clear that by mid-March that there was going to be no certainty or a certain timeline presented that we could feel safe and moving forward with, an event that brings 45,000 people together. So ultimately, it just came down to making the fair and reasonable decision to put our festival attendees' health and safety first. And we knew that we could always pivot and change and reschedule if local and national health officials allowed us to do so.
You mentioned health and safety. The announcement notes that people who are part of these communities are at greater health risk. Why is that?
Well, the community itself, just because of social, economical, financial, and just honestly being under-resourced really affects our community. Parlaying into that also, the financial devastation of the pandemic. Many LGBTQ+ workers, they work in service-oriented jobs. They work in the hospitality industry, the service industry. They work in very volatile and vulnerable fields that were heavily affected by the pandemic and closures of businesses. So take a community that faces disparities in their health coverage, their insurance, their job already, and then put these financial strains and on top of it. And so we really felt that the community would feel would be financially leveraged going into the season, and really wanted to make sure that we use Milwaukee Pride to showcase community partners and resources in the city that can offer resources and healthcare and resources for people to take advantage to stay healthy during the pandemic.
We're talking with Wes Shaver, who's the president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc., and we're talking about how people are marking Pride this year when major events, including the Pride Fest in Milwaukee, have had to be canceled, postponed until 2021, however you prefer to think about it. We're also talking about the latest Supreme Court decision on discrimination against people who are gay and transgender. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Rich from Rhinelander is ready to join the conversation. Hi, Rich.
Hi. We're feeling greatly rewarded for work that we did much earlier in our lives. I've been with the same partner for 46 years, and what I'm talking about is there's a legacy of discrimination. There's great happiness today, but I recall trying to get my premium insurance for my partner and simply being told over decades, that isn't done. That we like your work. We're glad you're here. We'd prefer that you weren't a gay man, but there's no way in the world we can negotiate with insurance companies. So in sum, there's also regret. We lost tens of thousands of dollars, and I'm not exaggerating, on shared benefit compensation simply because there wasn't a marriage decision and there certainly wasn't an employment discrimination decision as weighty as this one. So we're really happy and we're really regretful.
So Rich, this decision from the Supreme Court that sex discrimination includes discrimination for LGBTQ plus workers, it's not in theory for you. It's personal.
It's wonderful societally that this law, which had been interpreted to apply to a specific, we're all in this together, basically. I mean, this law was a law that determined basically that one half of humanity was equal to the other half. And now the law has been interpreted as saying the definition of sex is sex identity is sex identity. So I think we're going to face a terrific backlash from conservative religious communities. But I really do think that this is a great decision. That's all I want to say. It makes me think I'd like to go back in time and claim in a court of law. I'm sorry, but I lost a lot of money because
You had to have those individual plans instead of being recognized as a partnership. Rich, thank you so much for sharing your story and for talking with us during this conversation. Wes Shaver, one of the things I heard Rich talk about was the concept of equality. And we certainly want to talk about Milwaukee Pride and also the fact that you've been involved in the Black Lives Matter protests. Why are these organizations working together? Why is it important?
Well, it's extremely important because right now, really more than ever, the marginalized and underrepresented groups that have that intersect and share people really need to amplify each other's messages. In Milwaukee here, Milwaukee Pride did not organize a Black Lives Matter march or protest, because we didn't feel it was our lane. So there's also has to be mutual respect for these communities and these people who need to champion their efforts, and we need to then amplify. So, for example, right now there's a lot of overreach within communities, and there's a lot of colleagues and friends of mine that are people of color that really want this opportunity to lead their message, organize the marches, the protest, and they want our support. They want our 100% backing, amplification. And that's what's important about these smaller communities, these marginalized communities, that it's so important to listen to one another. And I'm really proud of, we have a local personality. I call him personality because he's an entertainer. He's an activist. His name is Montel. He spearheaded the local Pride March for LGBTQ plus people in support of Black Lives Matter and queer people of color. He put it together, and it was his initiative, and it was our honor and pleasure to follow suit, amplify, and be there in support. I think right now, while people may have good intentions of supporting, it's really important to be authentic. It's really important to amplify and support people in a genuine manner, not just say things on social media, share an image, It's important to show up, and it's important to be a part of the message, not just copy and paste one, if that makes sense. And I'm not trying to sound flippant or disrespectful to those who may not understand the layers of that conversation, but it is important to join forces, but it's also important to join forces respectfully.
Mm-hmm. Wes, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Wes Shaver is the president of Milwaukee Pride, Inc. We've been talking about a landmark Supreme Court ruling from yesterday about discrimination applying to gay and transgender workers under the idea of sex discrimination. And we have also been talking about what it's like to think about, celebrate Pride during this month when there are so many uncertainties. Up next is news. Then we've got a researcher helping us understand these fringe white supremacist groups that have been showing up at those Black Lives Matter protests. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Some members of far-right groups are turning up at protests over police brutality. It's true around the country and here in Wisconsin. Not everyone at these demonstrations supports racial justice. Some people, our guest says, are trying to hijack the gatherings for their own reasons. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're part of our conversation. What question do you have about what's happening here? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Have you been part of one of these protests? Have you noticed people who are working for a different agenda? Email ideas at WPR.org or call 800-642-1234. Our guest is Shannon Reed, an associate professor in the Criminal Justice and Criminology Department at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Her research focuses on street gangs and white power street gangs. Shannon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
We need to define some terms here, I think, before we move forward. What's the difference between white nationalist groups and white supremacy?
So people use these terms a lot of times interchangeably. They overlap quite a bit. Probably the most straightforward way to think about white nationalists versus white supremacists is, at the end of the day, they both feel that whites should be top dog. But white nationalists feel like they should have an ethno-nationalist state that is whites only. And white supremacists feel more that the white people are superior, and therefore, even if it's a diverse culture that they'll maybe tolerate, white should still be at the top of that food chain. But generally, they tend to blur together, right? I mean, if you feel that your white race is superior to another race, as you walk further down that line, you feel like you should be separate from all the other groups because you are superior. So they tend to bleed together. And you'll see in a lot of articles, people use them interchangeably. There is that slight distinction, but there tends to be a lot of overlap in sort of the underlying belief system of superiority.
So tell us about the far right groups that are participating in these protests in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd. Who are they?
So there are a lot of groups, and I want to preface that by saying these groups exist on a spectrum. So you have, you know, sort of what we study, which is the more youthful offenders who are out. They're the ones starting the fight. So we think about Proud Boys, Adam Waffen Division, the Rise Above movement, Patriot Prayer, who are showing up at a lot of these rallies. They tend to be younger. They tend to be involved in street level violence. And now and that goes all the way to the spectrum of sort of older, more established groups like the KKK, who may not be at these protests, but are still active online and in person in other ways. But the youthfulness is the piece that we are interested in, because with youth comes violence, right? And by youth, I mean sort of like that 13 to 25 range. They are the more willing to be violent, and so they are the ones that we see showing up at a lot of these protests. And now we're hearing things about Boogaloo Boys and other groups. So it's not that there are, oh, these five groups always show up, because there will be local groups, local people, local chapters. And I mean chapters loosely, but it's not like, oh, here's the five people who are always going to show up. It's going to vary by locality how they reference themselves.
Before we continue this conversation, how much attention should we give these far-right groups if they're showing up at protests trying to undermine the message that Black Lives Matter, that police brutality is unacceptable?
So I think there's, as a researcher, my answer to that is we need to be paying more attention to them, because there's a tendency, especially by law enforcement and some news, to sort of dismiss them as almost like a subculture, right? So if you think about them like, oh, these are just people going through a phase, right? They got sort of wrapped up in this internet, and they're not serious, they're not important, then we're not keeping track. And so if we don't keep track, we don't know what the reality is of how many people there are, who's doing what. We tend to find out about individuals as they participate in violence, and we can't avoid that violence if there's no sort of system in place to keep track. And so sometimes we liken it to the gang databases, which people have a lot of problems with. But especially when you think about places like Portland, where we've had a lot of white power groups pop up, but their gang database is majority minority. So if you have police departments and different agencies kind of dismissing them as, you know, people going through a phase or a subculture, then we end up missing them when something happens, right? It ends up being an internet where somebody tries to find whoever this is online, and it sort of becomes an online hunt versus this person is known to us, because chances are these people are known to the police. They're involved in other things, drug sales, other types of violence, sort of that cafeteria style offending that we talk about. So it's kind of a difference between who's paying attention. Do we need to talk about them in the news and sort of bolster them that way? Maybe less. But if we continue to ignore that they are a concern and ignore the fact that they are showing up to these things, then we are doing ourselves a disservice, because we don't know what to look for. And as researchers, we don't have a way to intervene. So, or policymakers, right? People are joining these groups for a reason, and the same way we did with street gang, who need to know what that reason is. And some of that requires keeping track.
Shannon Reed is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and she researches street gangs and white power street gangs. And we are talking about an effort by some far-right groups to undermine the protests against police brutality. And we're taking your calls, your questions at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the protests online or on social media? What are you seeing? What are you hearing from people who've been at the protests, or maybe you've been at one and you've noticed people who seem to have a different message than the overall demonstration? How much attention do you think we should pay to them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Shannon, you just mentioned Portland. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel here in Wisconsin reported that a man wearing a Ku Klux Klan hood and robe, or that style, was seen Friday evening walking his dog and waving at traffic in Vilas County in northern Wisconsin. How widespread are these beliefs about white supremacy?
Well, there was a survey that came out recently that said about 6% of the American population is sympathetic to these sort of white power beliefs. So it's pretty widespread. I mean, it's not widespread in the sense that everybody is involving themselves in this sort of quote unquote white power movement. But I think we have a decent population who is sympathetic to the cause. And I say cause loosely, right? Because they all have a slightly different cause. You know, everybody's coming at it from a different ideology, different angle. But I think we are seeing now that there are more and more people kind of willing to go outside and show up to these things and show that they are part of this white power movement. And I don't say movement in the sense of like there's organization, but when we think about all of the stuff that happens online and this idea of irony, right? A lot of these groups form online using memes and pushing this idea of ironic, like the Pepe memes and things like that, right? They're using irony. But even if that guy was wearing that KKK outfit ironically as walking his dog, at the end of the day, you're, whether or not you're wearing that ironically, you're still giving a racist message. So that's the problem with them saying, oh, I'm just doing this ironically. We see it with the white power, you know, the OK symbol. Oh, we don't mean it like that. It's, you know, so it's hard for people to, the average person, kind of disentangle who's being serious. So it kind of has been able to kind of come under the radar a little bit of if that guy gets arrested, he says, oh, I'm just joking. Right. Well, are you just joking? And to the person who sees you, is that a joke? Right. Probably not.
We've heard that from different. We've heard that from different groups too. Say something offensive and then say, "Oh, it was just a joke. It was just a joke." So therefore, you know, it's they're trying to take away the meaning from it. There's another kind of jokiness here. We just have a bit of time in this segment, but the Boogaloo Boys, sources say yes. They admit that they wear Hawaiian shirts. What is it about this group?
So the Boogaloo Boys are interesting. So they're very. Let me rephrase that. They're not new online. So they are coming out of the gun forums, like on 4chan and 8chan. They're sort of in the same way the alt-right was kind of the far-right, extreme-right 2.0, like trying to rebrand. It seems like the Boogaloo Boys are kind of this rebrand of the militia movement because some of them have white supremacy or, you know, white power leaning. Some don't. But they're very strongly pro-Second Amendment. And so the Hawaiian shirts and the igloos and all the coded language is to make them, again, stand out and bring attention to their cause, right? So a lot of the white power symbology has had to go back to stealthiness, right? Mm. It's hard for the average person to see a Nordic ruin on somebody and realize, oh, that's part of X group, right?
Right. But if you're part of that group, you're able to actually recognize it. And then it is, you know, some sort of coded message there. We're talking with Shannon Reed, who works in the criminal justice and criminology department at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And she researches these street gangs at white power street gangs. And we're taking your calls, your questions at 800-642-1234 as we discuss why some people who are part of these far right groups are showing up at protests in the name of racial justice and against police brutality. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Peely Boltina. Right now, we're talking about this idea that some far-right groups have. They're trying to widen our divisions and provoke law enforcement. Our guest, Shannon Reed, studies these groups and their tactics, and we're talking about them now because people who want to undermine racial justice are joining protests right now. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. How much attention do you think we should pay to these groups trying to undermine the goal of the protests? Do you agree or maybe disagree that they're actually discrediting the message? Why is that? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Shannon, what is the point that these white supremacist groups are protesting in the name of, you know, racial justice and trying to stop police brutality against people of color?
So there's sort of two purposes.
Okay.
So for the groups, say, like the Boogaloo Boys, they are potentially there because they are against big government. And they are probably more on the side of defunding the police because they want that military power, right? It's harder to enforce a red flag law if the police do not have sort of the firepower or sort of the ability that they have to, you know, come to your house and take your guns. If I have 47 guns and the officer only has one and no backup, that's a different, right? That it takes the teeth out of laws like that. So it's not necessarily that they are anti-police brutality. Some of them are, but it's more that they are anti large-scale police militarization. The other part of the groups, the more sort of white power groups that show up to these, are there for what we sort of talk about is accelerationism, which is the idea that if we are able to have a moment that sparks the national consciousness in such a way that we can hasten forward either a race war or a civil war. So they are hoping these moments, whether it's, you know, the reopen protests or the Black Lives Matter sort of anti-police brutality protests, if that's the moment, they will capitalize on that moment, right? It's less that they care if the state reopens. It's less that they care about police brutality in and of itself. But if these are the moments that will spark this revolution, then they want to be on the front line of that. And if they have to instigate it in any way, then they will do so, right? If it's looting, if it's, you know, these different acts that will kind of push things to a boiling point, then that's their end game. And I say their end game, again, not in a very organized manner. There's no 1,000-person group who's coming together to organize this. It's sort of more these small factions who, like the larger group, is sort of hoping this spark will happen, but there's no sort of organization about how they are going to do that. And so that's why, and for the reopen, there's a lot of room for recruitment. So we've seen this in other white power groups for the last, you know, since the beginning of, you know, the KKK. You take people who are unhappy and feeling that they are being taken advantage of or left behind in some way, and you offer them an answer to a problem. And if you show up at the reopen and you say, hey, let me tell you why the government's doing this, right? You start subtle and then you build into the deeper conspiracy theories. But those people may be more open to that versus when you show up at the police brutality, that's more, you know, there's probably less people to recruit, but more people to say, start this, you know, sort of explode this moment and exploit it for their purpose.
Shannon Reed focuses her research on street gangs and white power street gangs, and we're talking about why we're seeing some of these far-right groups or self-proclaimed members show up at protests that are actually in favor of racial justice and against police brutality. And Shannon, as we talk about these groups, there's not one big organizational umbrella. There aren't orders coming down from the top. Everybody shows up maybe for their own reasons. Should police classify some of these white supremacy groups as gangs?
Absolutely. And that's what we talk a lot about in our book, is that right now, police, policymakers, different agencies, even the public, right? When you see these groups, especially the groups of younger individuals committing these violent acts, whether it's beating somebody up or and it ranges from, you know, sort of a traditional hate crime all the way to non-hate crimes, right? Drug selling, there's been homicides of family members. So it's not always sort of ideologically based violence or ideologically based crimes. That if law enforcement took them seriously as a street gang, the way they do minority communities, we would be able to intervene in probably a lot of the same ways that we intervene with gangs. So when we talk to members of these groups, these white power groups, they show a lot of the same risk factors and sort of protective factors, if there are any, as street gang members. The problem is when most people think of a street gang, they think black, brown, you know, communities. They don't think white kids. So that's just a national, like, that's just a bias. It's a bias in our research. It's a bias with departments, police departments, law. You know, there's a sense that a white youth in these groups is just going through a phase, but a black or brown kid is a hardened gang member. So it's limiting both in what we can do as researchers, but limiting in what we can do as policymakers, right? So we know these programs work for gang members, but these members, these white member, right, sort of the racist members are not receiving these services because they are not given that label. And we can talk about whether we think labels are good or bad, but at the end of the day, if what these youth need are pro-social, you know, sort of opportunities, and they are not receiving them, then that should be an intervention point, a prevention point that right now everybody says, oh, I don't, why would anybody join these groups? And we know the answer to that if you look at the street gang literature.
Yeah. If police step up at these protests, if they recognize the dangers of having people of these far right groups there, and they act against white supremacy at the protests, does that solve the problem?
No, it doesn't solve the problem, because the problem is a community level problem, right? I mean, the same way street gangs are a community level issue, so is white power groups. So you can arrest as many people as you want, and they'll enter the criminal justice system and the prison system, where we have even more white power, more established white power prison gangs. So, you know, we need to go back to the community and really figure out why are people joining these groups? What are these groups, at least surfacely offering them, right? Gangs offer, they pretend to offer a lot of things, but they don't really offer much of anything except higher risk. So, you know, what are people being promised that they feel that they need, and how can we meet that at a policy level? The reason we need law enforcement to take them seriously right now is because we don't even know where to start, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know what schools these kids are coming from, what communities these youth are coming from, where these people are coming, right? We just have nothing. So if we want to institute a policy that targets them, we need to know where they are and where they're coming from. So we need law enforcement to take it seriously at that level.
Shannon, thank you for explaining your research to us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Shannon Reed is an associate professor in the Criminal Justice and Criminology Department at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Her new book called Alt-Right Gangs, A Hazy Shade of White, comes out in September. Just ahead, careers after college are evolving due to the pandemic. We're checking in with recent graduates and learning what the future looks like for them. Did you just graduate from college looking for jobs now? Do you have one lined up, but maybe it was canceled? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We're taking your calls as the morning show continues. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.